some of you, I hope nearly all of you, will remember that towards the end of last year, we went through a short series of studies, seven in all, on what the Bible has to say about family life. We looked at some big foundational questions. Why do we have families? Who invented the idea of the family? What's the definition of a family? What's the definition of marriage? Is it better to be married or single? What are the duties of husbands and wives to each other? What are the duties of children and parents? What about wider family? Where do the relatives fit into the picture? As I say, there were seven sermons, all dealing with those sorts of big issues. But when we came to the end of the series, I said that we would have another series in due time on family life, only this time on some more particular issues. And I suggested that you should tell me what issues and questions you wanted me to deal with in the new series. Well, tonight is going to be the first sermon in that new series. It'll run through, I hope, until more or less up to Christmas. So probably another six or seven sermons on family life. Now, I ought to say that as far as I can remember, I have only, in fact, received one definite request. Only one person has actually raised an issue which they want me to deal with in this series, and that was the issue of grandparents. How far should grandparents be involved in the bringing up of children? What rights do grandparents have? And we will get to that subject, God willing, sometime in the next few weeks. I've made a list of some other issues that people have brought up in conversation, at least, even if they've not asked me to deal with them in this series, and we'll deal with some of them. But it's not too late to bring up other subjects that you want dealt with. I need your help to know what are the things that are most relevant for you. Is it the difficulty of caring for the elderly? Is it the problem of coping with rebellious teenagers? Is it the question of divorce and remarriage? Are you wondering about fostering or adoption? It's for you to tell me what you want us to look at in the light of Scripture, and we'll try to deal with it. But tonight, we're going to talk about one subject that was going to be included in the last series. I announced that it would be in the series, but then we ran out of time and we never dealt with it. So we're going to look at it tonight. We're going to talk about brothers and sisters. What does the Bible have to say about siblings? And I've got 7 points I want to make. First, and the most obvious truth of all, it was God who gave us our brothers and sisters. It was God who gave us our brothers and sisters. Remember, we dealt with it in the last series, it was God who invented the family. It was God who invented this extraordinary and wonderful structure where you have father and mother and you have children who are all descended from father and mother. God invented the family. God it was who had the idea that it would be good for us to have brothers and sisters. Now, maybe we take that for granted, that that is the way families exist. But it shouldn't be taken for granted, because God could have done things very differently if he had chosen to. God could simply have created Adam and Eve, and then he could have, in some way, ensured that Adam and Eve would directly produce all the rest of the human race that was to be. So there would only be two generations, There would be Adam and Eve themselves, and then there would be all their children. So that none of us would have other folk who are uniquely our brothers and sisters. All the billions of the human race would all be equally closely related to me. That wasn't the way God did it. God chose that there would be particular people who would be my brothers and sisters in a sense in which other people would not be. Some of you will have read a frightening book by Aldous Huxley called Brave New World, in which he pictures the way that science and social engineering might develop. And in that book, he pictures children simply being produced in laboratories in huge numbers, so that rather than have a group of immediate brothers and sisters around you, you simply grow up as one of the whole you grow up as one who's come off a production line along with countless other identikit progeny. It could have been like that. There have been places in the world where social engineers have tried to take away the uniqueness of brothers and sisters, of that relationship. In Israel, they introduced the kibbutz system, where children would grow up as part of a commune, and where all the boys would be together in the same dorm, and all the girls would be together in the same dorm, so that all the boys would grow up thinking of all the other boys in the commune as being equally their brothers. And all the girls would think of all the other girls as being equally their sisters. The uniqueness of the brother and sister relationship was to be discarded. God planned that you should have some people of your generation who are more closely related to you than anyone else could be. He didn't turn us off production lines. He didn't make the world a giant kibbutz. He planned that you, I, should have some people of the same generation as ourselves who are more closely related to us than anyone else could be. Normally, that means that you are genetically closer to those people than you are to other people. You have at least one, in most situations, two common parents with your brothers and sisters. So you inherit some of the same traits as your brothers and sisters do. Physical traits, intellectual traits, traits of personality. You expect two brothers to have an awful lot in common because of their shared genetic inheritance. You expect them to some extent to look alike. You expect them their minds in some ways to think alike. You expect some common traits of personality to emerge because they're genetically related to each other in a way they aren't to other people. But you don't only have genetics in common with your brothers and your sisters. You also grow up in a shared environment with them. You come from the same womb. You play in the same nursery. You hear the same accents and the same vocabulary from the time that you're babies. You eat the same food, more or less, unless you're very awkward and refuse it. You play with the same toys. You've got the same examples in front of you all the time. The examples of your mum's behaviour, the example of your dad's behaviour. The way your mum treats you, the methods of discipline she uses towards you are likely to be very similar to the methods she uses towards your siblings. So you share the same genetic inheritance. You share the same environment. And you share many of the same memories. You know, when I sit down with my big sister, or when I sit down with one of my brothers, or even my little sister, we can talk about things in the past that no one else remembers, but which we shared. The tree house that my sister and I played in when she was 6 and I was 4. We share that memory. The time when we were pursued by a herd of pigs. And they were squealing and we were screaming. We only just got through the gate in time. We share that memory. Still vivid in my mind, and it's still vivid in hers. My sister shares so many of my earliest memories. The birthday parties, the games in the school playground, the happy experiences, the shocking experiences, being told bad news, going down with mumps or scarlet fever. I remember still that when we had scarlet fever, our beds were brought downstairs. And my sister slept in one bed in the living room and I slept in the other. And hers was a red divan bed and mine was a blue divan bed. Can't have been more than 3 or 4 years old. But we're linked by the memories of that illness. Brothers and sisters in a family share so much. And it's God who decided it should be like that. It's God who decided that in the normal course of events, most of us will have people with whom we are linked by a close genetic relationship. People who are shaped by the same environment that we've been shaped by. People who share many of the same memories. God didn't create the world and create the human race in such a way that I am equally close to everybody. He gave me those three things which link me uniquely to my brothers and sisters. So in that sense, we say that it's God who's given us our brothers and sisters. But not just that, he's given us the particular brothers and sisters we have. This is as much an act of his sovereignty as any other act. He works all things after the counsel of his own will. Which means that whether they are my brothers and sisters by adoption or whether they're my brothers and sisters naturally, he has given me, he has given you the particular brothers or sisters that you have. It's always worth. It's always vital that we remember that. That as we look at our brothers, as we look at our sisters, with all that's delightful about them, with all that's irritating about them, we say, it is God who gave me that particular brother. It's God who gave me that particular sister. The delightful things about them, I must thank God for those things. The irritating things about them, I must accept it's God who wanted me to have an irritating brother. It's God who decided that I needed to have an irritating sister. God planned that for my good. All things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. If God has given me the most irritating sister in the world, and he hasn't, thankfully, if he has given you the most irritating sister in the world, then if you are a believer, you can say, God gave her to me for my good. God gave her to me because there were lessons I could learn from our relationship that I couldn't have learned in any other way. We are to recognize God's hand in the brothers and sisters that he has given to us. That's the first lesson then, that it's God who has given us our brothers and our sisters. The second lesson is this. Brothers and sisters have a special responsibility to care for each other. God laid that down in his law. Even in the Old Testament, the law he gave to the Israelites. He said, brothers and sisters must care for one another. He listed out some of the responsibilities that brothers had to one another. If a man became destitute and was in danger of being sold as a slave, or had been sold as a slave, then it was his brother who had the first duty to step in and ransom him from slavery. If somebody had become bankrupt and had had to mortgage his land, it was the brothers who had the first responsibility to bail him out and to redeem his land. Sometimes the responsibility of a brother could be very demanding. We touched on it this morning, the levirate law, by which if a man died and his widow was left childless, it was the man's brother who had to step into that situation and marry the widow so that she would have an opportunity to have children. Brothers had the most wide-ranging responsibilities for one another. In the book of Proverbs, we're told a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. God causes brothers to be born so that they'll be there for one another in the times of adversity, so that whoever else steps in or doesn't step in, that the brother does step in. Older brothers in the Bible are seen as having a special responsibility to protect their younger brothers. Do you remember in the story of Joseph in the Old Testament? Joseph insists that his baby brother Benjamin is taken down into Egypt. And Benjamin's dad, Jacob, is horrified at the thought of my baby being taken off to that far country. And it's Judah who steps into the situation and says, I will be a pledge of his safety. I'll lay my own life on the line to protect my younger brother. Older brothers have got a responsibility to protect the younger brothers. And especially in the Bible, it's made clear that brothers have a special responsibility to protect their sisters. That's very politically incorrect to say, isn't it? Nowadays, a man who shows any special care for a woman is frowned upon. But in the Bible, it's taken for granted that brothers are there to protect sisters against all the threats, all the dangers of this world. When in the book of Genesis, Genesis 24, Abraham's servant arrives or is sent to find a wife for Abraham's son Isaac. He goes to the house of Bethuel, who is one of his relatives. And Bethuel has a beautiful young daughter, Rebekah. And Abraham's servant, Eliezer, thinks, this is the woman. This is the woman for my master Isaac. And he approaches the family to say, you know, I've been sent to find a wife for Isaac. And I think Rebekah is the woman. Who is it who takes charge of the situation? It's Rebekah's brother. It's Laban. He's the one who wants to investigate. He is the one who wants to make sure that Isaac is actually going to care for his sister properly, that Isaac's got the financial means to do it. He's got a responsibility to safeguard his sister, not to let her be exploited, not to allow her to be threatened in any way. brothers in the Old Testament are always seen as having that responsibility of guarding their sisters against marauding, irresponsible men. In Genesis 34, you get Jacob's daughter, Dinah, being horribly abused. And what happens? Simeon and Levi, her brothers, they're the ones who step in and say, "We cannot allow the abusers to get away with this." They know they've got a responsibility to protect their sister. This is brought out especially in the Song of Solomon, the Song of Songs. And right at the beginning of that wonderful song, and then again right at the end of it, you see the brothers of this young girl taking charge of her and protecting her. Protecting her both from men, irresponsible men, and protecting her from her own vulnerability, from any silly, dangerous behaviour she might get into. This is what this girl says at the beginning of the poem. She says, "Do not gaze at me." She's talking to the ladies of the palace. "Don't gaze at me, because I'm dark. The sun has looked on me. I've not looked after my complexion. I've got myself sunburned. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyard, but my own vineyard I've not kept." She's not looked after her complexion. But what was she doing working in the vineyards? Well, her brothers had decided that that was what was best for her. They were going to make sure she grew up a hard-working girl. They were going to make sure she grew up in an environment in which she was safe. And so they sent her out to work in the vineyards. And they had the right to do it. It was part of their protection of her. And then at the end of the poem, you've got the brothers themselves talking about the way they view their sister. "We have a little sister," they say, "and she has no breasts. At the moment, she's still very young. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? As she gets older, as she becomes to be of marriageable age, she will need protecting then. Well, if she's a wall, we'll build on her a battlement of silver." Do you understand what that means, if she's a wall? If she's the sort of girl who keeps up her defences, if she's the sort of girl who is ready to keep men at arm's length, well then, we'll honour her for that. We'll deck her out with jewellery. We'll build battlements of silver on her so that she'll be attractive to the right man when he comes. We'll decide who that is. But if she's a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. Do you understand that? If she's a door, if she's the sort of girl who'll open up to anyone, if she's the sort of girl who'll just throw the doors open and not take precautions, well, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. We'll make sure she's guarded from her own naivety. We'll protect her. Brothers have got a responsibility to guard their sisters. It's a dangerous world out there, and it's especially a dangerous world for young girls. Now, obviously, dad must take responsibility too. But brothers have got that special responsibility to watch over their sisters, to guard them from all the dangers that come in this dangerous world. Until the brothers have seen the girl safely married and into the hands of a husband who will protect her, they've got the duty to protect her safety and her honour. Point number three on the subject of brothers and sisters. When brothers or sisters work together, they can be a formidable team. When brothers or sisters work together, they can be a formidable team. God can use the natural closeness of brothers or sisters as a great asset in his kingdom. By putting two lads in the same family, by giving them the same genetic inheritance, by giving them the same environment to shape them, by giving them the same memories, he's equipping them to work together. They can work together very easily and naturally because they know one another so well, because they're so alike in so many ways. And so very often, God uses the natural closeness of brothers or sisters as a great asset in his kingdom. Let's ask examples, please. Examples of brothers whom God used together for his work. Question for the under tens. An example, please, of brothers in the Bible whom God used together as a team. Start in the Old Testament. Start with a story we talked about this morning. Remember we talked about God meeting somebody at the burning bush? Who did we talk about this morning, Vicky?
Moses.
And God says to Moses, I'm sending you to the Israelites. And Moses says, I can't go. I'm not up to it. Because I've not got the gift of speaking. I'm no good at talking to crowds of people. I'm not eloquent. And God said to him, you've got a brother. What was his brother's name? Josiah?
Aaron.
He says, you can be the team. You'll work together. The gifts that you've got and the gifts he's got will fit together wonderfully. Aaron can do what you can't do, and you can do what Aaron can't do. God equipped Aaron and Moses to be a great team. Another team of brothers in the Bible. Go to the New Testament. Pretty obvious. Bethan, you're too old. Yes, John. Yes, John. John. Sorry?
John and James.
Two brothers whom Jesus chose to work as a team. He's only going to choose 12 apostles. But those apostles include two brothers, James and John. What was the label that people put on them because they were so much alike? They were very similar personalities. And people called them the sons of thunder. Because they were both thundering big characters. James and John, wonderful team together. They'd work together as fishermen in a family business. They were used to working together. They were good at working together. And the Lord Jesus says, I can use that. You can be a team in my kingdom. Another pair of brothers then. Since we're talking about the 12 disciples. Come on, Jesse. They weren't among the 12 disciples. We may talk about them later. There was another pair of brothers among Jesus' disciples. We've got to sack the Sunday school superintendent, I think. No. Come on. Go on, Bethan. Peter and Andrew, Simon and Andrew. Again, they'd worked as fishermen together. And again, the Lord Jesus chooses them as a team. Only 12 apostles. But among the 12 apostles, two pairs of brothers. There are others mentioned as well in the New Testament, a pair of brothers called Rufus and Alexander. They worked together. What about sisters in the New Testament? Can you think of a pair of sisters who worked together? I can think of a pair of sisters where the two sisters had very different personalities, but they still worked. Go on, Meg.
Mary and Martha.
Mary and Martha. And they also had a brother, of course, called... called Lazarus. Two brothers and a sister working together as a team. It was in their home that the Lord Jesus stayed during the last days of his life before he went to the cross. Paul in Romans mentions two sisters called Tryphena and Tryphosa. And he calls them those workers in the Lord. Team of workers. And it's been like that down through the centuries, not just in New Testament times, but many times God has chosen to take two brothers, two sisters, and to use them in a special way. And they've been much more effective working as a team than they could have been working individually. There's in the church library, there's the biography of Robert and James Haldane, perhaps the two most effective evangelists that Scotland ever knew. Great Calvinistic Baptist evangelists. Great team of brothers working together. Maybe that's something that you should be praying about. Those of you who are growing up and who have brothers or sisters, you can pray, oh God, help me to have the sort of relationship with my brother, with my sister, that you can use in your kingdom in years ahead. Fourth lesson I want us to think about from the Bible is this. When relationships between siblings, brothers or sisters, break down, the hatred can be very deep-rooted. Just talked about brothers working together, sisters working together. It's wonderful when that happens, when there's that sort of close relationship between brothers and sisters that God can use. But it's also true that relationships between brothers or sisters can break down, and they can become very bitter, and the hatred can become very deep-rooted. Again, give me an example of two brothers in the Bible where the relationship broke down and where at least on one side deep, deep hatred took its place. You don't have to go very far into the Bible. Ollie. Cain and Abel. The first pair of brothers ever born on earth. And one of them finished up hating and killing the other. Another example. Go on a little way into Genesis. Vicky?
Jacob and Esau.
Jacob, who was so jealous of his brother Esau. Esau was the firstborn. Why should he be the special one? Esau's the one who's going to be specially blessed. Why should he have the special blessing? I'm cleverer than he is. I'm smarter than he is. And Jacob finishes up cheating his brother Esau. And then Esau hates Jacob. And Esau is determined to kill Jacob. The relationship between them isn't a relationship of love and closeness at all. Wonder how old they were when they started feeling anger and hatred towards one another. I wonder when they got into a habit of squabbling and getting angry with one another and jealous about one another. I don't suppose it suddenly kicked in when they were 15 or 16 or 17. I would guess it was when they were very young that they started drifting apart. Let's have other examples. Two sisters who have a huge rift between them in the Bible. You sure? Do you want to go? I thought your hand was up just now, no?
Oh, thinking that one called Hannah, not sure what the other one was.
You're thinking of Hannah and Peninnah. Were they actually sisters? I didn't think they were. No, I don't think so, but well remembered. You can go back before that, though. We just talked about Jacob. Who did Jacob marry?
Sarah.
No. Who did Jacob marry? He married two sisters. And what were their names? Meg? Leah and Rachel. How did they get on together? They were so jealous of one another. They were just in a competition with one another. Leah would say, I want to be the one that Jacob loves most. And Rachel says, I want to be the one that Jacob loves most. Leah says, I want to be the one who has most children. And the sister says, I want to be the one who has most children. And they're arguing and they're fighting and they're hating one another. Of course, it wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been so much deceit in the family before that and if Jacob hadn't married both of them. But here were two sisters who finished up hating one another, fighting against one another all the way. And then, of course, that knocked on into the next generation. How many children did Leah and Rachel have between them? And they used their servants as well, their maid servants, to produce even more children. How many children in all? Go on, Meg.
13.
12 brothers and one girl that we know of. And how did those brothers get on? Fighting, the quarrelling between those brothers, and especially the hatred the 10 of them had for Joseph. They were so jealous of him. They knew he was Dad's favourite, and they wanted him dead. The Bible is full of examples of brothers and sisters who finish up hating one another. In the examples we've just given, it was open hatred. With others, it never actually reached that stage. But there was still coldness. There was still estrangement. Brothers who just don't really want anything to do with one another. How many brothers did David have? Anyone know? Seven brothers David had. He was the eighth. He was the baby of the family. Do you know something? In all the years when David was wandering in the wilderness, as far as we know, none of his brothers came to help him. None of them stood with him. None of them protected him. There just doesn't seem to have been any warmth between David and his brothers. His nephews, the sons of his sister, they stuck to David. They came to his help. But his own brothers, as far as we know, never did. And when David became king, none of those brothers, as far as we know, came to join him at court. None of them became his counsellors. None of them were among his bodyguard. David and his brothers just, there doesn't seem to have been any real close relationship between them at all. What leads to rifts, whether it's open hatred or whether it's just coldness between brothers and sisters? In most of the cases we've talked about, it's jealousy, isn't it? One brother looking at another brother and being jealous of him. One sister looking at another sister, being jealous of her. Instead of each of them giving thanks for their brother or their sister and saying, thank you, God, for what you've given to them, you've got brothers and sisters who resent what God has given to the other one. Younger brothers sometimes resent and are jealous of their oldest brother. Why is he allowed to do things I'm not allowed to do? Why is he always treated as special? Why is he in charge when mum goes out? Why does he have the right to boss me around? And older brothers are sometimes jealous of younger brothers. Why does he get away with it? Mum lets him get away with things that I wasn't allowed to get away with. Why is it that I've always got to take the blame? When there's a row in the house, it's me that Dad always picks on and says, well, you're old enough to know better, and blames me for it, even when it's my younger brothers who have started it. Jealousy, if it's allowed to grow, can finish up with brothers hating one another. It did with Cain and Abel, didn't it? Why did Cain hate Abel so much? Because he saw that Abel's sacrifice was accepted and his wasn't. It's not fair. Sometimes it's not particularly jealousy that leads to these rifts between brothers and sisters. Sometimes it's just that brothers and sisters are incredibly irritating. Brothers and sisters have irritating habits and irritating ways. You share a bedroom with your sister, and you're good at keeping things tidy and she's not. That can be so irritating, can't it? When you spend your time tidying the bedroom and she spends her time wrecking it. Here's bad jokes. Your brother tells such dreadful jokes and you have to hear them over and over and over again. Because every time there's a visitor, he tells the same dreadful jokes. Little irritating habits. When you see irritating habits in your brother and sisters, how do you react to them? Do you just become more and more angry? Do you brood on it? Or do you say, well, thank you, God, for giving me that particular brother, that particular sister? Sometimes brothers or sisters get into the habit of putting one another down. You know what I mean by that, don't you? Squashing one another. That can lead to real hurt and bitterness in the long run. Just talked about David and his brothers and how little closeness there was between them. I think we've got one hint about how that started, why it was like that between them. It's when David has brought food for his brothers. He's been sent by his dad to bring them food. And it's at the point where Goliath is challenging the Israelites, and nobody is willing to stand up against Goliath. And it's at that point that David turns up and says, you know, why is Goliath being allowed to get away with this? And Eliab, his oldest brother, finds that so irritating. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when David spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart. You've come down to see the battle. You're just an idle, lazy, nosy little boy. Why have you turned up here?" And David said, "What have I done now? Wasn't it but a word?" And he turned away from him towards another person he spoke in the same way. The people answered him. They answered his question. But his brother is the one who's got to put him down in public. I'm sure that rankled with David. They could never accept David as their equal, because he's the lad who should be at home looking after the sheep. And I doubt if he could ever forget the way they had put him down again and again. So many things that happen in a family home which can lead to bitterness, hurt in the long run. Proverbs chapter 18, verse 19. "A brother offended is more unyielding than a strong city." A brother offended is more unyielding than a strong city. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying, once you've got a rift between two brothers, once one of them is offended, it is so hard to put things into reverse. It's so hard to break down that barrier then. It's like trying to break into a city that's got all the defences up. I know two lads who grew up in a Christian home. And as children, as boys together, they found one another irritating. And they got into a habit of trying to have as little to do with one another as they could. If this one's going out, this one's going to stay in. If this one's staying in, this one's going to go out. And they stopped talking to one another. Avoided ever speaking to one another. And that became more and more habitual, to the point where in the end they never spoke to one another. They would be sitting there at the same meal table, and they couldn't speak to one another there. It would be, "Dad, will you tell him to pass me the salt?" And so it went on, so it festered. Year after year after year, it happened in a Christian home. Both boys professed faith in Jesus Christ. Both boys wanted to be involved in Christian service as they became young men. And still they couldn't speak to one another. That could happen in your family. It could happen to any of you youngsters, boys or girls, sitting here tonight. If you let sinful jealousy, if you let resentment, if you let hurt fester, if you let a relationship break down between you or your brother or your sister, it may never be repaired. You could finish up like Rachel and Leah. You could finish up like Cain and Abel. You could finish up hating your brother, whom God gave you to love. And a relationship that ought to be such a strength could become just a nightmare. It could happen to any of you. How you need the power of the Lord Jesus in your heart, enabling you to put away jealousy and irritation the moment it raises its head. I said 7 points. We've covered 4. I'm going to make the 5th, but I'll make it brief and I may go back over it again next week. Number 5. Rifts between brothers and sisters can be healed. I've got to say that. Having said number 4, I couldn't not say that. Rifts between brothers and sisters can be healed. That's wonderful to know, isn't it? That however deep the rift has gone between a brother and a sister, or between a brother and a brother, or a sister and a sister, however deep the bitternesses are, the grace of God can triumph, can bring these two people, these brothers, these sisters, back together again. Even naturally, the bonds between two brothers who have grown up together are very deep. Or the bonds between two sisters who have grown up together are very deep. We talked about that at the beginning, the genetic bonds, the bonds of environment, the bonds of all you've shared down through the years. Those things go very deep. And so when two brothers who have been estranged from other do come face to face, there are those times when there can be a great surge of affection again, even naturally speaking. But how much more when both the brothers, or when even one of them, knows God and knows the grace of God and is willing to forgive and has been praying that God will break down the barriers. You see it, don't you, with Jacob and Esau. All the years when Jacob and Esau have been estranged and there's just been hatred between them. But then Jacob meets with God. He meets with God at the place called Peniel. And he wrestles with God, and God breaks Jacob's pride in that place. And Jacob becomes a new man with a new name. And at last God is ready to bring him and Esau face to face. Jacob is sure that Esau will try to kill him. And yet Jacob makes his preparations to meet his brother Esau. He wants the past to be forgiven. He wants to start again. That's what he pleads with God for. He pleads with God that God will be working in Esau's heart as he's been working in Jacob's heart. And this is what we read. And it's lovely to read. Jacob went on before his family, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Jacob's got no pride left to hold on to. He's willing to bow down before his brother. If that's what it takes to make peace, he'll do it. He'll take all the blame for everything that's happened over the years. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. All the years of coldness, all the years of estrangement, and they're over. God can do that. Later in Genesis, Joseph and his brothers, the brothers who hated him, the brothers who threw him in the pit, the brothers who sold him into Egypt. God works in them. God uses all sorts of circumstances to humble them, to show them how wrong they've been. He works in Joseph too. The day comes when God is going to bring Joseph and his brothers face to face. They don't know it is Joseph. Joseph knows it's them. And Joseph is ready to forgive the past. He knows that his brothers have changed. And then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I'm your brother Joseph." And then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. This is supernatural grace. Undoing all the damage of the years. Healing relationships that couldn't have been healed in any other way. The gospel, the good news, saving power of Jesus Christ. What does it do? It breaks down the barriers between myself and the God I've offended. There's never been a rift, never been a quarrel that's gone as deep as that. The quarrel I had with God. On my side, it was just willful wickedness that made me quarrel with God. On God's side, it was righteous anger. He had every reason to frown on me. But oh, how deep the rift went. But God broke it down. He took the rebel and he made me his friend, his child. If God could break down the rift between me and himself, then he can heal any rift between any two people. The same grace that restored me to God's favour, that took away my enmity, can take away the enmity between two brothers, two sisters, a brother, a sister. Isn't that something to pray for? Some of you maybe have grieved for many years, as Joseph grieved in Egypt, because of broken relationships. And some of those broken relationships may be broken relationships with brothers and sisters. They can be healed. I'm not saying they always will be here in this world. But the same God who answered Jacob's prayers and answered Joseph's prayers can answer your prayers too.